Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Wisetail. Ever wonder how winning brands like Shake Shack, Chopped, and Torchy's Tacos scale their business and train employees, all while delivering an exceptional customer experience? They do it with Wisetail. Learn more at wisetail.com.
This week on Meet and Three, we bring you a sensational episode where each story hones in on one of the four senses that accompanies taste.
Many of the smells that we encounter in everyday life actually exist out there in the cosmos.
Food carries all these culturally specific meanings. The fact that, you know, when you see an apple, it's not just an apple, right?
I was mostly interested in thinking about what knobs ASMR was pulling on, maybe, or how we could explain it from a psychological or emotional or evolutionary standpoint.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. We got John from Customer Service joining you from the new lab in Brooklyn. Nastasia from Topanga Canyon, where for reasons that are too complicated to discuss, she has to go outside to use the bathroom.
At least for
number two. We could talk about it later maybe if she wants to. We got Matt in his Rhode Island hidey hole doing the engineering. But today we have on special guest Harold McGee, who's coming to talk about his new book.
Thank you.
Nosedive, a field guide to the world smells. What is that? How are you supposed to say the title of the book, Harold? Is that like how do you want it emoted?
Boy, that's something I have not considered. I'll think about that and get back to you.
I mean, like, I only know how to do it in kind of like, you know, the monster nosedive. That's all I can do. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But then, you know, a field guide to the world's smells, and there's the world's smells, kind of slows you down, right? So maybe it should just
a field guide to the world's smells. You think the apostrophe S and the S in the smells is what's, you think that's slowing me down?
It's slowing me down anyway. Nothing slows you down.
is it what, like, do you want it to be more like, in a world? Like that kind of like nosedive, a field guide to the world smells. Like that? Like more like a little bit foreboding?
Yeah, I like that. Especially with the American jacket, you know, it's kind of dark, mysterious. Yeah. Whereas the UK version
is... it's got an incense.
Yeah, that's right. Smoke curling up into the atmosphere. But the English one is very, very different. It's a white cover, and it's got an Erlenmeyer flask with all sorts of different things inside the flask.
Those lousy Brits. So you're doing two editions at once, the British and the American edition?
The two of them are coming out simultaneously, yeah. And then there are a couple of translations in the works, one in the Netherlands, amazingly. I thought, and my experience has been, that the Dutch, all Dutch speak English better than I do, but they like to read it in their own language. And then in Spain, a translation is also being done.
Nice. Into Spanish.
Yes.
Yeah, not into like Catalonian or something. That would be on point.
Right.
You know what I mean? Nice. All right. Well, I hope that it's a while before you have to deal with your persnickety Japanese translator. That was a nightmare for you last time, right?
It was, in a good way. And actually, I've been kind of going through that with the Dutch translator, who's very good. He's a scholar of food history in his own right, and So he's had all kinds of questions, and some of them, caught me out. So I've learned a lot dealing with translators.
So this book is not like your other books in that it is, you're a food person, so you do talk a lot about food and cooking in it, but that's not what it's about. You want to give people the kind of nutshell of what you've come out with here. First of all, how long you've worked on it, like just give an outline of the project.
All right. So it started out 10 years ago as a book about flavor, taste and smell, the things that make food delicious and interesting. To me, anyway. But as I began to write about taste and smell and foods and so on, other things kind of bubbled to the surface. First of all, it seemed to me that I wanted to focus on smell because taste is, of course, really important, but we can detect maybe, something on the order of a dozen tastes, plus or minus. But we can detect hundreds, thousands, maybe more different smells. So smells are what give foods their particularities. And
I must ask, wait, who has the bell?
Yeah.
I have the bell, and I have not been able to track down where it's coming from. I'm sorry.
It's the sound of wisdom, man.
I did. It kind of was going off. It was like to emphasize, like, good point, or you might learn something here, which I've okay. So listeners, that's what that is.
You can only taste 10, 12 things. Ding.
For the rest of the show, this is intentional SFX. You're welcome.
Or what I can do is I'm pretty sure it's coming from the phone, which I'm using to record. I could just shut it off and not have that second and not have that backup. So up to you guys.
Sure, or turn down the volume on the phone.
It's, it's not supposed to have notifications going, so.
The man just told you, Matt, that he can't address why it's dinging.
Okay. Then, turn it off, I guess.
Okay, I'll do that.
Man, that's a momentous decision right there.
I don't know, yeah, it's going to bite us in the butt later. All right.
Okay, so give me a sec. Sorry about this.
It's okay. It's okay.
Okay. It's off. Anyway, so I was thinking about writing about flavor, focused on smells, and then began to wonder why it was that smells kind of echo each other, and I figured that it had to do with the molecules involved. So, Parmesan cheese can smell like pineapple. And there are reasons for that. But then I began to wonder why it was that foods can smell like or have aromas like things that are not foods. Okay, I'm being haunted.
And now, Matt, we also don't have
now we don't have a backup recording, and we have the bell. We're really killing it today.
We let the man finish. It's the sound of wisdom.
I'm haunted. Jeez. I'm haunted early. I'm really sorry about this.
It's fine. We've addressed it enough that the listeners are just along for the ride now.
Okay. Wine speak. People often talk about wines having smells like, sweaty saddles, for example, or rocks, minerals,
my nickname.
That kind of thing. Yeah. So I began to wonder why these other things in the world have the smells that they do. And that ended up really grabbing my attention, because people have written about the olfactory chemistry, the volatile chemistry of foods and drinks, but not so much about the rest of the world. And I thought it would be fun to try to pull all those things together. And it ended up being fun in a way. I enjoyed those 10 years, but then I also didn't enjoy those 10 years because I was late in delivering my book for 8 of those 10 years. And that's not...
Jeez, I have no idea what that feels like.
Right. Anyway, so the book is now a field guide to the world's smells, in which food and drink play a part, but And an important part, because those are where we mostly encounter smells these days. But it does try to cover everything else that I could think of and that there was data for.
And speaking of data, so for those of you, this is a tome. This is not like some sort of Pollen-esque, light read tour through. This is on the order of, not as long as, but on the order of On Food and Cooking, in that you start with kind of the structures of the early universe, volatiles that might be around, and then how the Earth kind of came to be, and then the building blocks, volatile smell building blocks that kind of life created, and then you kind of ramify from there, here's what plants can do, here's what animals can do, and then go into an in-depth kind of description of all that along with what the individual compounds are that do it. So it's one of those things where you kind of need to read it at least twice. Wouldn't you say that's accurate or no?
Well, I guess I did mean it, or it did turn out to be in the end, something like a field guide, which is something that you don't necessarily read from cover to cover. It's something that you kind of browse in the first few chapters to get the idea of, what birds are, or what beetles are, that kind of thing. And then when you see something or hear a bird call that interests you, then you go back home and open up the field guide and try to figure out what it was. So that's how I intended to be used, although I did also try to make it readable so that if you happen to be interested, for example, in herbs and spices or in incense or something like that, that you could sit down and spend half an hour learning something about those things.
Right, but you should really spend, in other words, I think to really get the most out of it, there's a section near the beginning, I forget what you call it, it's not like building blocks, it's, what is it? It's like you have a chart and you take like a chapter or two, what do you call it? I'm going to have to flip through the book now because I have a copy of it here. The basic building blocks and what the structures are. Oh, like the starter set and then beyond the starter set into the first couple of things. And you kind of need to go over those a couple of times because you're going to keep coming back to those again and again. And I think understanding those kind of basic building blocks is going to help you understand the stuff you write later. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I do think so. And I think it's just an important point in its own right that there are such things as building blocks, life. With all its diversity, when you begin to fracture it and break it back down into its smaller constituents, you end up with the same basic set of small molecules that are small enough that they're volatile, that they can leave whatever it is they're in, fly through the air and end up in our noses, which is the prerequisite for anything having a smell. So yeah, living things in general tend to fall apart into this starter set of different molecules, and we encounter them all the time.
And then also you interesting in the section on plants, for instance, you say, okay, listen, plants need to make these kind of structural and food storage molecules, and there's these specific pathways, and then on those specific pathways branching off are all these side reactions that create all of these crazy volatiles, and you kind of go through, and so it's kind of a pathway by pathway look, here's what this pathway does, and it's an interesting way to look at, and I think part of what you say in the intro is once you kind of start understanding these kinds of pathways and how they're related, it can actually make your experience of the whole world more interesting.
Yeah, that's my hope. Certainly the way I experienced it, because going into it, I knew food and drink pretty well because I'd been writing about those things for a long time, but I had not been writing about plant biochemistry. I had not been writing about the early history of the earth and the smells that come out of volcanoes and things like that. So I was learning all that stuff for the first time. That's why it took me 10 years. But what really intrigued me was, why do these things exist? Why are those particular molecules there? And in the case of plants, which are stuck in one spot in the earth and can't run away from predators, they have to defend themselves and deal with the world essentially chemically. And so they take advantage of the pathways that they use to make their physical structures, to make chemical structures that can serve them well to repel predators or to, to be come-ons to animals, to pollinate their flowers or to disperse their fruits. And knowing that all that kind of thing is going on when you enjoy a mango, for example, I think adds to the experience of mangohood.
Yeah. And one other thing I'll note is that while you do not stint ever on using the names of the compounds and the families of compounds that are in it, because I guess you want people to know, right? You don't have to know the stuff. You don't have to absorb everything to go to a later chapter and read about something, and you could still get the main gist, the thrust of the argument without, if you don't know a terpenoid from a lactone, you can still get the general gist of what's kind of going on. So I would say don't be frightened of the fact that it does have all of this actual kind of chemistry in it. Would you agree with that or no?
Again, that's certainly my hope. And I tried to arrange things to make it as easy as possible to skip over that stuff if you don't happen to be interested in it. So there are tables of the component smells that make up the smell of a particular thing like a mango, and then the molecules that are responsible for those smells. The molecules are there, for people who are interested in the chemistry, and I became interested, so that's why I've included them, but also to make the point that these are not tasting notes, these are not some person sitting down smelling a mango and coming up with, well, it's got a pine note and a strawberry note and a this note and a that note. It's not subjective. These are molecules that have been found in all these things that are responsible for the component smells that give us the overall smell. So it's there. The molecules are there largely to make the point that these are not subjective notes. These are what science has found to have been involved in these wonderful smells that we enjoy.
So before I get to the listener questions, I know Nastasia wants to talk about one specific section of the book. Stas,
my favorite part in the Herald, you and I, when we were having drinks, explained it to me before the book came out, but that certain people, certain cultures don't have body odor or bad body odor, and I find that so interesting. Can you talk about that?
Sure. And that's something that I learned and, took a couple of months to make sure that I really understand. It's really fascinating. So turns out, I figured going into writing about the human body that most of the smells that we emit are kind of accidental. We have microbiomes, bacteria and yeasts and all kinds of little creatures that live on our skin and inside us. And it's largely their activity that that causes the breakdown of our molecules into small things that are volatile and that we can smell. What I didn't realize was that our bodies have taken advantage of that fact. And so they actually make certain molecules that are brought to the surface of our skin, which microbes then process in such a way as to give us our human body odors. And it turns out that certain groups of human beings on the planet have more or less of these kind of specialty products that are meant for microbes to process to give us the smells that we have. And it turns out that Europeans, apparently coming out of Africa and then spreading into Europe and into Asia, we started out with a pretty good complement of molecules that would end up smelling once bacteria on our skin got a hold of them and released them. But as culture, as peoples evolved separately, some of those smells became, for whatever reasons, that still the biologists are still working on this, but for whatever reason became less useful or maybe got in the way of something or other. And so it turns out that people in Asia tend to produce much less or even none of the molecules that people of African and European ancestry do that end up giving us a much stronger body odor than people in Asia have.
Crazy. Crazy.
And yet another reason we're hated. Okay.
But Harold, but Harold, say the one thing when Asians smelled or saw Europeans for the first time, then they smelled them, they were like, whoa, right?
There are terms in Chinese that mean essentially the smell of the barbarian, or stories about Europeans who are able to turn from human into fox and vice versa, but they keep the same smell, and so that's how you know who or what are. Yeah.
let me get to some listener questions, because you know I could ask, you know, we could ask Harold questions all day, and then I will have asked people to ask questions in vain. And also, Matt, you're keeping an eye on the chat room in case people pop in, right? Okay. Chris writes in, I have a question. Why does white, and this is actually covered in the book, Chris, so if you buy the book, you wouldn't have to ask. Why does ground white pepper smell like horses? It does. That's what he says. That's his note. It does. I just say I don't use it. And Nils Noren, our old compatriot, hates it because he thinks it smells like death and mold. And first of all, like, whatever. So go give me some white pepper, Harold.
Right. So black pepper is black because it has the fruit coat of the pepper fruit still intact surrounding the seed. And white pepper is white because that fruit coat has been removed in the processing. And the easiest way to remove the fruit coat on pepper fruit is essentially to ferment it, to, you know, make big piles and then wet the pile down. And then microbes get to work fermenting the fruit pulp. And it becomes very easy just to kind of wipe it off. And so that's how you get white pepper, is to do this fermentation step and then clean the fruit of the fruit pulp, and you're left with the seed, which is white. The problem is that fermentation is usually taking place, well, I guess always taking place, in tropical conditions. And those fermentations are wild, so that they are sometimes less than pleasant. And when that happens, you can end up with volatiles that come from the fermentation, not from the pepper itself. And that's what you're tasting when you're tasting white pepper that is funky. And most white peppers are funky, some less than others. It depends on how that fermentation has been controlled, if at all.
Now, follow-up question, is there any reason, if you throw out black specks as a reason to use white pepper over black pepper, is there any reason that white pepper exists?
Well, I can see, I'm not a huge fan, but I can see, you know, that it would, if you, in small doses, it might give an interesting sort of background complexity to something. But you certainly wouldn't want it to be front and center and freshly ground.
And as a follow-up, You quote Pliny at least twice in the book at the beginning of chapters. In one quote, he says that he detests the taste of pepper. Why would you ever quote him again for anything else?
Because I think he was asking in that passage a very good question, which is, why would human beings bother to be interested in this kind of thing? Why would they want to, you know, give themselves pain and value that kind of sensation so much that the cost of pepper was comparable to the cost of gold? That's what he was talking about in that passage.
So you think he was actually being thoughtful and not just ragging on pepper and pepper?
Oh, I think both. I mean, he was, ragging and insight are not necessarily to be dissociated.
Fair point. Fair point. All right. Peter Stewart writes in. I have a smell related question. Why does raw egg make dishes smell like wet dog? And is there a simple way to neutralize it? If it gets in the dishwasher undetected, it can spread to the whole load of dishes, which is a problem when you live with a nose. You want to talk about what a nose is, and then maybe if you have an answer to the question?
Okay. Well, a nose, I'm assuming that a nose in this context is a nose in the larger culture, which is someone who has been trained to pay attention, very close attention to smells, and that's usually someone who is working in the flavor or fragrance industries. So this is an interesting question. I remember talking about it with Audrey Saunders years and years ago, because she, to her, it was a problem that comes up in any drink that's made shaken with an egg white. The shelf life or the bar life for her was very short, because that smell would develop very quickly. Dave, is that something that you would agree with?
Yeah. I mean, that's why, like, the best salute. The problem is that people like to see the egg freshly cracked out. I mean, that smell dissipates over the course of a couple of hours. So if you crack it out before service and let it kind of air out, it'll go away. But I don't think that'll stop the dishwasher smell, which might be a reification of the smell. I never looked into it. I just, you know, I was like, I can't solve this. So, you know, Audrey's was to cover up the aroma, and mine was to either, like, not use the egg white or wait, you know, and so I don't know.
Yeah. So ever since Audrey pointed it out to me, I've been interested in wet dog smell and eggs, and have been searching for an answer. And what I've come up with are, you know, little fragments of possibilities, but no unified theory for why it is that eggs have that wet dog smell. People have studied the smell of wet dogs, amazingly. In fact, that's one of the cool things that I was just amazed at over the course of the years I was writing this book, is how many oddball things scientists have gone to the trouble to track down and figure out. So there have been, you know, gas chromatography, olfactometry studies done of wet dogs, among many other things. And to make a long story short, because it is just a series of possibilities, wet dogs themselves have actually this molecule cresol, which is also one of the culprits in the smell of white pepper that we were just talking about. So it's possible that because egg whites are basically all protein plus water, and protein is rich in nitrogen, and cresol is a byproduct of the breakdown of amino acids, that for some reason there are just traces of that particular molecule in egg whites, which some people are really sensitive to and others just aren't. But there are other possibilities. I mean, I came across a paper about the smell of the off smell of fish and fish oils, which can be pretty nasty. which discovered a molecule which, when isolated, according to the authors, and this is back in the 90s, smelled like, had the very characteristic smell of meringue, which is egg whites, right? So, and that turned out to be an aldehyde, nothing to do with cresol, but an aldehyde. So I think basically what we're chasing after is some trace compound that science has not yet tracked down completely. I don't understand why it is, and I'll have to experiment with this, why it is that the smell would smell would spread in a dishwasher, which is, you know, it's probably alkaline conditions in there, and so that's probably going to do something to the chemistry and to the volatility of the traces that are still in there. But good question.
Scrub steel has a similar smell, so, you know, I can often confuse the egg smell with freshly scrubbed wet steel in a dishwashing situation. So I also wonder whether maybe there's some of that, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting, because the smell of fresh metal surface has amazingly enough, carefully studied. And those are very particular aldehydes again, and ketones. So not related to amino acids at all, but to actually what you're smelling is not, of course, the metal, which is not volatile, but volatile molecules that are generated by the contact of the soap molecules with the metal. So these are, you know, 8 and 10 carbon fragments that we associate with the smell of metal, because that's when we smell them. But it's not the metal itself. It's these other materials that come in contact with it.
Hmm. All right. So I have a question here from our friend up in Connecticut, Wowie Zowie. Says, not exactly aroma-centric, but would love to hear Harold's thoughts about a Serious Eats article on debittering olive oil. And I looked it up. It's Nick Sharma, who's coming out with The Flavor Equation, The Science of Great Cooking, which is, I guess, due out this month, maybe already out for all I know. I haven't read it yet. Basically takes olive oil, and then to make emulsions that don't get bitter, he puts a lot of hot water into it, which absorbs the polyphenols and then decocts it and then makes an emulsion with it. So I'm assuming that at that point, you're like, why use the olive oil, right? I mean, I don't know. Why don't you just tell me what you think about that idea, if you've read about it or heard about it?
That's exactly my reaction. Why bother using olive oil? So that's a technique. What you're basically doing is washing out non-oil materials from the oil by mixing it intimately with water and letting the oil and water separate from each other. Pouring off the water, and then you're left with the oil, and it no longer has those traces of bitter and other compounds, including aromas. And that's a technique that has been used for centuries, actually, to take rancid-smelling oils and get rid of the rancidity. So you can find that kind of procedure called for in books going way, way back. It does work, and I think Nick also recommends it when using mustard oil, which can be bitter and is used a lot in Indian cooking. But that's exactly my question: is if you don't want the particular qualities of olive oil and mustard oil, and by the way, the bitterness in olive oil is actually an indication of its polyphenol content, which is associated with good things for our bodies, then what you're doing is basically taking away the molecules that give those oils their specific identities and qualities and perhaps health benefits in order to have a kind of blank background. And so you could do the same thing just by using canola oil.
Yeah, right. Especially if you don't believe in any of these purported, I guess you're saying even the purported health benefits you'd be washing. All right. So why use it? Maybe you have a surfeit of olive oil lying around. You know what I mean? Maybe you're like swimming in olive oil and trying to find uses for it. Whatever. By the way, what percentage of olive oils do you think turn bad when you make a mayonnaise out of them?
Sorry, which percentage of olive oils
like get that like intensely bitter thing when you make mayonnaise out of them?
My experience is that it really depends on how you make it. So if you make the mayonnaise by hand, I find that you don't generally have a problem at all. It's when you use a blender. So my guess is it maybe has to do with the processing of the oil, the size of the droplets, how much of the stuff that's inside the droplets gets exposed on the surface of the droplets. That might be what's causing the bitterness, but I think it's process dependent.
This episode is brought to you by Wisetail. Ever wonder how winning brands like Shake Shack, Chopped, and Torchy's Tacos scale their business and train employees, all while delivering an exceptional customer experience? They do it with Wisetail. Wisetail is a state-of-the-art learning management system built to engage and empower your workforce. With a modern user interface and intuitive course authoring capabilities, Wisetail has helped hundreds of businesses achieve their growth goals. Plus, Wisetail has experts on call to help you bring your vision to life with their world-class client success team. Come see how Wisetail's award-winning training platform can go to work for you. As a special offer, HRN listeners are eligible for their first month free. Learn more at wisetail.com/HRN. That's wisetail.com/HRN. wisetail.com/HRN. Terms and conditions apply. Visit their website for more details.
All right. We have a question in from Rachel Meyer. I wonder whether that's the Rachel Meyer from Shoots and Roots. Interesting. She asks, what's really behind smelling sweet? What does sweet smell mean?
So that's a really good question. I have a couple of pages about that because in the chemosensory world, in the world of people who especially think about the flavors of foods, it's often said that talking about sweet smells is actually a mistake or a kind of uncalled for attribution to smells of something that's actually due to an association with a taste. So we say that vanilla has a sweet smell because we always encounter it in sweets. And so we make that unconscious association and we use that word for it. But my argument is that, in fact, if just go back to the Oxford English Dictionary and look at the history of the use of the word sweet, it's used to mean pleasant way, way back, but long before it was associated very specifically with sugars. And I think that there's a lot to be said for using the term sweet to mean soothing when it comes to smells. I'm talking about soothing smells, pleasant smells, smells that you have pleasant associations with. Flowers can smell sweet, and we don't necessarily have a lot of experience with flowers, floral aromas in sweets. Certainly, in some parts of the world, there is that association, but for us, not so much. So I think it's a perfectly useful word when describing smells. It's very general, but it essentially means pleasant.
What about in a related note? So like honey, remember we used to do the demonstration together. I guess John hasn't done it, but like Nastassi and you and I have done the demo many times where you chew on or eat some geraniumic acid, Geranium sylvestri leaves. It wipes out your sense of sweet, and almost nothing tastes sweet. Everything is ruined. Exception being honey still tastes slightly sweet. I always assumed that was an aroma situation that I was literally integrating in my mind as sweet. No?
My guess with honey is because there's so many different sugars in there, maybe something's getting by. Something's triggering a receptor that the geraniumic isn't somehow blocking. That would be my guess. But I think a good, didn't we do marshmallows? And yeah, and they have some vanilla in them, and they were not so nice. So
they're terrible.
Yeah, yeah. So my guess is it's the bizarre range of sugars that you find in honey that might be doing that.
I haven't done that in a long time because it's unpleasant.
Yeah, question in the chat. Want to do it?
Okay.
Are there any good resources on esters, like a database, specifically if you want to associate them with different spirits like rum or whiskey? And then he explains that he finds it strange. He can't stand whiskey. It smells like used baby diaper. I'm a dad, he says. Whereas rum is like chocolate, vanilla, raisins, cola nut, and notes in between that can't play specifically. And he said that he also throws in that he's one of those people for whom coriander taste smells like some sort of soap or detergent, and he wonders if there's a correlation.
What are you feeding that baby?
You gotta get that baby to go to sleep somehow, you know?
That's right. Yeah, my father, when I was in my 30s with children, finally admitted to me that I was regularly doped up as an infant to keep me quiet. So
nice. What was that noise, Nastasia?
Yes.
I don't know. I caught it as more of a
no.
Well, and I now use that as an excuse for all kinds of things. So,
I see.
Anyway,
Brandy,
my dad,
Brandy, baby Brandy. Yeah. Nice.
Anyway, so esters. Well, so the book does have a two-page spread of the most common esters that are found in food and drink. I'm not aware offhand of a kind of specialty chart for spirits, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if one didn't exist somewhere or other.
Make it sound so racy, a two-page spread.
When it comes to why it is that you experience whiskey the way you do, and possible correlation with your experience of coriander, cilantro, that's an aspect of the perception of smells that I chose deliberately to ignore in the book, because it is so subjective and complicated, and the book was going to be long enough if I just paid attention to what's out there, whether or not or how we perceive it. I can't really come up with a good explanation there, and I'm not sure that anyone else can at this point, except to say that we do all have different sets of receptors. We all do have different processing circuits in our brain, because those are built by experience. And I would take it as an occasion to think back to your infancy and early adulthood and see if you can come up with any interesting associations from your own life.
John, you're not a whiskey guy. Do you get any diaper action out of your, any baby poo out of your?
No, I do not. Yeah, I don't. I don't know what about the flavor. I guess I've never really taken the time to just like sit and think about why I dislike whiskey so much. I just know I don't like it when I taste it.
Well, you told me it was a mental thing because of a bad experience.
Yes, bad experience when I was young and silly. I think that has to do with it, yeah.
What happened? Yeah.
I just graduated from high school, went down to Jamaica with some friends, and got in a hot tub with some Jack Daniels and some SpaghettiOs, and needless to say, things did not go well.
Whoa. Give me that trifecta again. You're in a hot tub.
SpaghettiOs, Jack Daniels.
Ew.
Oh, my God.
That's our customer service person. Yeah.
I stole a bottle of Jack Daniels, but I could afford SpaghettiOs. Let's get in the hot tub. Is that how that went? Was that the gist?
No, I don't really remember how it all happened. It just was. I remember the end of the evening did not go well, and the next day didn't feel
I bet
well.
You do.
Yeah.
That's a nice color floating on the top of that pool.
Yeah, well, thankfully made it into the bathroom. Not quite to the toilet, but yeah.
Oh! Yeah. Harold, you still have not listened to the Dead Milkmen song, have you?
No, I have not.
These are a few of my many smells off of their smash hit album, Beelzebubba.
Okay. Thank you for reminding me. I will do that today.
Yeah, come on. I'm sure you have one of the Spotify's or iTunes. I mean, not that it's a great song, but I mean, how many Dead Milkmen song relate directly to, a book that you've written?
That's right.
Yeah. You know, the Dead, I'm sure like none of you guys even remember who the Dead Milkmen were. Like, they, you know, you might know them, Bitchin' Camaro and Punk Rock Girl were their two biggest songs. Anyways. Ashmit writes in, hey, Harold. And also, he wishes us well. So that's nice. Okay. My question is about the difference in taste in butter of different animals, cow and water buffalo. In India, I don't know if it's present in the U.S., the butter from a cow is much more aromatic and stronger tasting in a good way than the buffalo kind, which tastes fresher. I bought the two types from the same brand, and the difference is still quite noticeable. Both of them were uncultured, which removes the possibility of fermentation introduced diacetyl. Why do you think this? What do you think the disparity is? Is it related to the yellow hue of the cow kind, or is it simply because they are two different animals? Am I thinking about this too much? And is this also the case in the United States? We don't get buffalo butter here in the United States. And I will throw into this an added thing: if bonus points, Harold, if you can talk about camel milk.
Well, on the point of camel milk. I myself have not tasted it, but I was shopping at a wonderful grocery store in Sacramento called Corti Brothers, which I really want to take you guys to when that kind of thing becomes possible again. And they actually had dehydrated camel milk and dehydrated horse milk. So I bought a can of each. It was expensive stuff. Like, you know, $30 a can, something like that. But I gave them to my daughter Florence, who is who spends her weekends with horses. That's kind of her avocation, is working at a horse ranch on weekends. And so I gave them to her as a kind of, you know, oddball stocking stuffer. And she was grateful for them, took them home, and then we have the lockdown, and we haven't been together since. So I hope she still has them. I will check, and if she does, then I'll give you some notes on camel milk.
All right, and then we'll read them on the air. You can come back. You know, you don't have to wait until you come out with a book to come on the show, by the way.
Okay.
I mean, people enjoy when you come on. to the buffalo cow does the butter in the cows that they have in India differ from ours in an uncultured, et cetera, the whole deal?
Yeah. So cow's milk and water buffalo milk are very different, and there's a page in the book about that difference. They're different in all kinds of ways. The water buffalo milk is much higher in protein and fat, both. But then the other thing about milk is that it really does get a lot of its flavor from what the animal is eating. I think probably a big part of the difference that the caller has experienced in between those two milks has to do with the feed. The milks themselves, I mean, we can kind of get an idea of it here if we buy burrata, for example. which is sometimes made with cow's milk, sometimes made with water buffalo milk. And it's kind of, you know, on the edge between cheese and butter. And they have very distinctive flavors, but it's, you know, it's not a huge difference. And I think if there's a huge difference in India between those two, then it might have a lot to do with the typical feet that they have.
Well, we'll have to take a trip and find out once all this is over.
That's going to be our mango trip, right?
Yeah, we're going to go down to the south. Hey, look, I'm game. We almost made it that 1 year. I forget what happened, you know. Because you still have your hookup, right?
Yeah, still have friends there, and they're happy to make arrangements for us.
All right, well, as soon as we're allowed to. What's the season there? When's the
it's right time? It's spring, late spring. Yeah.
Nice. All right. Yeah. All right. Miguel Cepeda wrote in, I have a rotary evaporator to distill things, and I have the aromas, and I pass them on to my dishes, but it occurs to me to try to distill rusty metal nails to get those metallic aromas. And so this is going to – you spent a lot of time several places in the book talking about what actual aromas of things like metals are, so that's why this is apropos of the book. To get those metallic aromas similar to the truffle – which you also spend a good deal of time on. And the question is, can I obtain those aromas and flavors, and are they safe to consume? If so, what temperature do you recommend using in the rotary evaporator to take care of the terpenoids? But I wouldn't know what terpenoids would be present in there. But anyway, so basically the distilling the smell of rusty nails.
Right. I can kind of hear them clanking around as the rotary.
And the ting, 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 ting. Yeah.
Well, so those molecules have been characterized and are well understood. And as I mentioned earlier, they're kind of medium-sized aldehydes and ketones, about 8 carbons long. And so those will have a very particular volatility, particular partial pressure with whatever solvent you're using. And so, yeah, you can you should be able to get them and maybe even focus on them by getting the conditions just right. No terpenoids in rusty nails, but again, what these molecules are organic molecules that are broken down by coming into contact with metals, which are very reactive and cause them to break down. It's the same thing that happens, you know, if you smell the keys in your pocket, they have the smell they do from the oils from your fingers that you've left on the keys when you've handled them. So it's not the metal itself, it's the other stuff that gets broken down by the metals.
And would you say that those things are relatively temperature insensitive, or should you go on the low side?
Well, so aldehydes and ketones are both kind of reactive. Probably going with the lowest temperature you can is the best idea. Yeah.
Now, you have a section about the smell of, or again, you talk about it at the beginning, but you also talk about it close to the end of the book. And, you know, the smell of just freshly wetted earth and dirt and concrete and whatnot being this kind of like blooming from carbon dioxide, like, you know, the microbes come back to life, make carbon dioxide, it raises these volatiles. I mean, that's the gist of the argument,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But what about the actual smell of curing concrete?
You got me.
You know that smell when you walk past curing concrete? I'm trying to, so since this stuff is probably not volatile, and for those of you that have never had the pleasure of in the summer walking past a large amount of curing concrete, it has a very specific smell and a cooling effect. I love it. I love walking past a big concrete pour in the summertime. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, we had a concrete driveway poured at our house decades ago, and yeah, that was I hadn't thought of it until this moment, but yeah, it's vivid, and I have no idea.
And I forget, you write about this again in the book, And, you know, I used to know it back when we did the flavor exhibit at MOFAD, but there is a mental relationship in my head between curing concrete and green bananas, but I don't know what it is or whether that's just my brain playing with me or not.
Yeah.
I'll figure it out. Actually, I won't figure it out. I'll never figure it out. I'll forget about it again until I ask you again in like 10 years time. Okay.
Don't ask him too many stumpers. We got only, you know, like 10 minutes left. Also, Gurin confirms that he too had a bad experience with whiskey, so this whole thing is suspect.
I'll say suspect. Look, your bad experience that you have is very real. I mean, all of this stuff's just mental. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's exactly why I chose not to write about it. Is that we all have different experiences, so we're all going to have different experiences of food and drink and smells in general in the present. And so I just wanted to get out there what the stuff is that stimulates our perceptions, whatever those perceptions might be.
I mean, you touch a little bit when you go into the kind of cilantro thing, right? It's like there are many people where cilantro tastes like soap and yet they still like it.
Yeah, or they can, it's maybe not their immediate reaction to it, but they get it. They can say, yeah, there is a soapy aspect to this, but it's also herbaceous and fresh and nice.
I would say delicious soap. That way you're selling. Yeah. You got to always be selling. All right. Devin Patel wrote in, hello, I've been on a quest for some time now trying to understand the flavor and aroma formation in coffee roasting. I'm not talking about classic coffee flavors like furans or phenols, but the fruity esters, ketones, etc. Do you have any recommended readings on flavor formation caused from thermal degradation? Oh, man, he's right in your wheelhouse here, Harold. There is little info on the internet on the subject. Any help would be much appreciated. I'm assuming buy the book and then look at your bibliography section.
Yeah, that would be a good start. but I would also say that you don't necessarily have to go to the book. These days, and I write about this in the bibliography section, that it's never been easier for anybody, including me, to find exactly this kind of information. You just have to get used to dealing with Google Scholar. You just go to Google Scholar and you type in coffee and whatever particular notes you're interested in, and up will come a list of the publications that have covered it. And then oftentimes those publications are behind paywalls, but the abstracts almost always contain the information that people like us are interested in, which is, you know, what are the most important molecules and how are they formed? And then if you really want to get take a deep dive into the science of it, then...
Would you say a nosedive?
Or even deeper. Then there are ways to get around the paywalls, but for the most part, you can find tons and tons of information these days. That's part of what kept me going for 10 years.
We're allowed to talk about Sci-Hub here.
Ah,
on radio.
Okay.
Yeah. No one's going to bother us about it. Yeah. All right. Deepit writes in from Toronto. Hey, have a question for Harold. My partner cannot stand the smell of tequila. Fermented dairy such as yogurt and sour cream and black vinegar. Is there a common molecule that is present in all of these food or drinks that may be the culprit? I imagine lactic acid is a likely one, although not in the vinegar, but not sure whether tequila has any lactic acid in it. She has similar issues with mezcal, but finds the extremely smoky examples tolerable, which is a flip. Anyway, so any commonalities there or just very disparate dislikes?
Yeah, I'm... If I had half an hour, I'd sit down and look at the charts that contain have that information and look for a molecule that they share in common. Offhand, I can't think of one because they are very different materials.
Why does sour cream and yogurt smell somewhat acidic when the lactic acid is not volatile the way that acetic acid is?
Well.
Is it just a mental?
No, it's so that's a really interesting question. Lactic acid, should not be volatile. And yet, if you buy supposedly pure lactic acid and smell it, it does smell kind of dairy-like. So my guess is that there are trace molecules associated with lactic acid that are detectable, that are really hard to get out of lab preparations of things like lactic acid. But the other thing is that in the case of sour cream and yogurt and things like that, lactic acid is certainly produced, but so are all kinds of other acids, including butyric acid, which in excess can be, butyric acid, if it's kind of moderate amount, it's kind of cheesy. If it's much more than moderate, then it really begins to get, you know, disgusted, rotting smelling.
Stassi says the same thing about me.
Traces of butyric acid just smell acidic. They're you know, a little bit like vinegar, you know, but without the distinctiveness of vinegar. So there's a kind of sharpness that all the organic acids share, because they are volatile and they do what vinegar and CO2 and things like that do in our nose. You know, they hit our acid receptors, or our, this also gets complicated, acid receptors, but also pain receptors. So there are all kinds of things in dairy, in fermented products in general, that give us that kind of sharp acidic hit.
So the outlier so far is tequila, which I don't know enough about the stuff in it to tell you, like,
but I'm,
all right. Yeah.
I was just going to say, tequila, of course, is also a concentrated fermented product, and so I wouldn't be surprised if maybe there was an acidic component that the caller is just especially sensitive to.
All right, we got two last. I'm going to rip through it. We're going to do it, Matt. It's going to happen.
Okay, I'll set the two-minute timer. Ready?
All right, it's going to take me 2 minutes to read this question. Well, I was like, Harold, by the way, what Nastasi is doing is he's going to set a two-minute timer, so you have 2 minutes to answer these next two questions, right? All right. From John Secord via email. Hey, everybody, and Harold. I feel like this might be a good question for Harold. I recently made cacio e pepe. Say cacio e pepe for me. I love it. Cacio e pepe. You usually say it. You're just not doing it. She turned off. She muted.
I muted because my Airbnb person was, like, talking to me.
Oh, did you ask them why they didn't install a bathroom in their house?
Did you hear me ask them that right
no.
now? Okay,
no.
Well, then I didn't.
Well, I didn't hear all of it because you muted, remember?
Yes. And if I had asked him that question, you'd think it would have been a 2-second answer that he would have given me.
It would have been like, nah, we skipped it.
I just want to give him crap.
Nah, we skipped it. Okay, cool, bye.
I mean, that checks out. Anyway. Why no turlet? Goodbye. Anyway, I recently made cacio e pepe, and the recipe calls to toast, in quotes, the ground black pepper in the pan for a few minutes. This certainly releases some very wonderful aromas, but I'm curious as to what it does to the overall flavor of the pepper. Another pepper question. I recently had Caesar dressing with a lot of pepper. They had a very mild black pepper flavor, and I have a feeling they muted the sharper flavors by cooking beforehand. I know that Dave has cooked mustard seeds and garlic in a pressure cooker, but what do you think would happen if you cooked pepper? And then there's another section on yay toast and Brunos, but we'll deal with that later because unless Harold has a burning desire to talk about brown Scandinavian cheeses. Go pepper.
Okay. Okay, cheeses are all yours. Pepper. So whenever you toast spices, you're doing a couple of things. One is that you are helping to release the aromas, because the aromas are held in little cellular containers, and those need to be broken open before we can detect the volatiles that they contain. But then the other thing is that that wonderful smell that you're getting as you toast them is going up into the kitchen air and out of the pepper. So the pepper may end up having much less flavor than it did to begin with, depending on how long you've toasted it. So just be aware of the fact that that's the case, that you're on the one hand liberating aromas and to some extent creating them with a high temperature, but you're also losing them at the same time. And so my advice would be to use a mixture of fresh ground and toasted, and then you'll get the best of both.
All righty. Well, that's always like you know, Jeffrey Steingarten used to say, why do you add pepper at the beginning? Yeah, but I'm just adding something. It's he's already answered. It's over. So, add at the beginning and at the end. I like a double pepper addition.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah. Because I like the bitterness, but then I also like the aroma. Kind of like hops. You know, you had some for the bitterness and some for the aroma. Anyway. No, remember we started talking about something else and then I said that I was going to talk about something else? Anyway, Brian writes in and would like maybe, like, Harold's going to be the most important, but then, you know, invites us to weigh in, which is very nice. Brian from Minneapolis. My question for Harold, for the new book, Nosedive, is what's the best and worst thing you smelled while doing research for your book? This question could also go for anyone else on the show.
That's a tough one. Two minutes of silence. How about that? Well, you know, I did feel obliged because the book covers smells good and bad. I did feel obliged to pay very close attention to excreta of all kinds. And I did it for the book. I wouldn't willingly do it again. Most pleasant. That's tough.
Wait. So like how many different kinds of poop are you talking about?
Whenever and whatever I would come across. We've had a raccoon infestation recently, for example.
So, all right. How does raccoon poo smell as opposed to
other
poop?
It's they're omnivores, you know, so it's not as bad as after a human being, for example, has a nice big steak.
Mm. The steak poo, that's the worst thing you're saying that you smelled for the book? Is this worse than the surstromming?
Oh, that's, surstromming, yeah, that's right up there. That's right up there. But, you know, that's something you can eat. And then, so that's got a different kind of valence to it. You know, it is something that you can sort of appreciate. In a different sort of way.
One can eat it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Nastasi, you were there for that one when Harold was like, this one's not as good because it doesn't also have that Susan vomit. Because like, the one that we brought back, it's like didn't have quite enough of a vomiting note for Harold to say it was the height of Sir Stroming.
Well, that was only my second Sir Stroming. The first one did have much more... the vomit, the baby poop, it just had a richer palette of aromas than the one you got.
Oh, yeah. And so what's the best? Was agar wood really great?
That's pretty wonderful. I would say that the incense materials in general, which I had not known anything about until I started working on the book, and thankfully, Mandy Aftel, the perfumer in Berkeley, you should look her up at Aftelier. She has a collection of these amazing natural materials, incense woods and resins and gums and ambergris and civet. And they are out of this world. So I began to understand why it is that they were used and valued as much as they were.
Alrighty. So the non Herald questions have been postponed until next week. The week after that, we're not going to have a show because election, and it's going to give all of us agita, so we're not going to do a show. Is the book available right now, or do they have to wait before they go buy it?
It should be on shelves and in stores right now.
Remember to buy the American version with the incense on the front and not the British version with the Erlenmeyer. Did you go through and change all the spellings of all the words, like labor and color and flavor?
Nope, that would be up to the English publishers, and I think they just took the same plates as the American edition.
Well, thank goodness for that. The book is Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells, but I just did it with a normal voice at that time. Nosedive. Like, you haven't decided how you want me to read it. Anyway, the book is Nosedive, available at fine booksellers anywhere. Harold McGee, thanks so much as usual, and hope to see you in the real life when all of this COVID nonsense is done.
Yes, yes. Can't wait. It's been way too long.
Can't you wait? Can't you wait, Harold, to do another big party and dress up like Zoltar?
Well, if we can have toppling grills and everything that we had that time, sure, anytime.
Yes, for sure. Right, Dave? Always.
Yeah. You know, but at this time, I want him to just dress as a giant nose, like the. Whose short story is that? The nose.
Gogol.
Just dress as a giant. Gogol. Yeah, Gogol. Yeah, the nose.
Yeah.
And then we'll only play Parliament. I am the nose, devoid of funk. That one, you know, and I will never dance. And we'll just do that the whole time. And like, so you can be dressed as a giant nose in the Parliament outfit would be amazing.
Yes, I like that. It's good.
That's the next.
We would have done that for your book release party if we weren't in COVID.
If we weren't in COVID times. But for those of you, like, when we do our next museum, whatever it's called, Nastasia will make sure that that happens.
Yeah.
And so you will get to see Harold dressed as a nose in a Parliament outfit, like, if you shell out for the next California MOFAD event once we're all allowed to have these sorts of things again. Would you say it's accurate, Nastasia?
Absolutely. Laying down the foundation now.
Laying it down. While she's sitting there stewing in beautiful Topanga, other than
remember last week when I was like, I don't really want to let people know where I'm staying, and you were like, okay,
no, yeah.
Does everybody remember that? Do I just want to be clear?
Or is it a red herring? Are you not in Topanga Canyon, and Dave is just leading him astray?
No,
yeah. I'm not that smart.
Right.
Anyways, by the way, California people, is the air mellowed out yet? Can you see again?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, it's fine at the moment. Yeah.
All right, good. All right. Well, anyway, best to everyone, and Harold, hopefully, again, see you soon. Bye, Nosedive. Cooking Issues. Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.